Good morning. In the wake of the Brexit vote, two words are now being heard in and out of Britain. What now? We'll talk about the impact on Hawaii with the chief economist at the Department of Business, Economic Development and Tourism, Eugene Tian. Meanwhile, Hawaii special education students forced to leave school illegally have another chance to get the services they missed. Many families don't know they're even eligible. Attorney Michelle Como gives us an update. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoot. When little Albert started his performing career, he really was little, all of 7 years old. He's never left the stage, and he's with us this morning. And if you think love and basketball don't mix, you need to see Lysistrata Jones at Manoa Valley Theater. It's likely you'll look at the sport in a whole new way.
That's The Conversation. Coming up next, the news. Welcome to The Conversation on this Monday, June 27th. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Lots of backlash in the wake of the Brexit vote and talk of unintended consequences.
Yeah. Many unintended consequences and people wondering if they made the cast the wrong vote and regretting what perhaps they've already done. But, you know, it's over for the moment, so we're going to pick it up and see what happens from this point forward. Now, you know that last Friday we woke to an unexpected result to Britain's referendum on its participation in the EU. The UK had decided to leave. Since then, there have been some calls for a do-over, citing a lack of real understanding, as we were just talking about a moment ago, about the vote's implications. Now, regardless of how that turns out, many people around the world are wondering, well, what now? And so are we. We called the State Department of Business, Economic Development and Tourism to get a fix on the impact Hawaii may feel from the Brexit. DBED's chief economist, Dr. Eugene Tian, joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
How healthy is Hawaii's visitor count from Britain?
Currently, we have about 50,000 visitors from UK.
So, I mean, not huge.
This 50,000 is actually a decrease from the early 1990s. In 1990, visitors from UK was about 100,000. And currently, we are standing at about 50,000.
We're having a really difficult time hearing you. There's a lot of backfeed coming to me from you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can hear you clearly.
Okay, good. I think that's a little bit better. All right. So with about 50,000 visitors from Britain, how concerned are you that the Brexit will change what little bit we feel from the British visitor content?
I think the separation from UK from the EU will be impact Hawaii negatively in a certain degree. Although the whole Europe, the total visitor arrivals from European countries is about 143,000. So you can have a feeling about the 143,000 compared with Japan, Japanese visitors, 1.5 million. And you compare with Canadian visitors, is about 500,000. And you compare with Chinese visitors, about 180,000. And you compare with Korean visitors, about 170,000. So the European visitors is relatively small at about 1.7% of Hawaii total visitors. But the impact will be mostly through the visitor spending. It's not so much on the arrivals, on the number of people traveling to Hawaii, but it's on their spending, how much they spend on a daily basis.
Right now, it's a great deal if you happen to be an American in Britain. That usually isn't the case, but for right now, it's going well in that direction. Clearly, what you're saying is that with a lot of uncertainty surrounding what may happen with dollars and the amount that visitors coming from Britain may spend, we should be a little wary. Anything in your mind that sticks out particularly as a difficulty in getting through to those who are in the EU and those who are in Britain about visiting Hawaii?
Yeah, I think there will be some decrease in vegetation from UK and maybe coming from European countries as a whole. And we have already seen during the first 4 months, the widget arrivals, actually, it didn't decrease much, but the spending has been declining from Japan, from Canada, from visitors in other countries, including Europe. So that is the impact of this exchange rate impact, because the dollar will appreciate. That will not impact too much on the U.S. visitors, because we are still using the U.S. currency, no exchange rate impact. But from other countries like Japan, and with an appreciation of the U.S. dollar, the Japanese spending will have a negative impact.
So that doesn't seem to be a rosy picture in many fronts or on many fronts. As you look, though, at trying to market Hawaii to Britain now in the wake of Brexit, is that going to be more difficult?
I think this is the marketing is done by the Hawaii Tourism Authority. They actually have a marketing company. It's called Tourism Europe, Hawaii Tourism Europe. I think they may have to do some special marketing and finding some new strategies to attract more visitors. Actually, Hawaii Tourism Authority has been doing diversifying the tourism market. For example, the traditional visitor market in Hawaii is the mainland visitors. Consists about 61% of our total visitors and Japanese visitors. And in recent years, we have more visitors coming from other Asia, like China, Korea, and also in the European countries. We actually was a all-time low in 2009, and we actually have increased last year in 2015. So that is due to some marketing. I think the Hawaii Tourism Authority will have to consider some new marketing strategies.
Have you had any conversation with them about what they might need to do, or to just generally talk about what Hawaii might be like in the wake of Brexit?
Yeah, not at my level. We haven't discussed at my level.
If you were to advise them, what would you say?
I think that would be more diversified, even within the European market. Maybe more emphasis on the other growing market like Germany, France, Switzerland, those other countries.
They're also deeply concerned about the effect that Brexit will have on them. Do you look at Europe as being a little more dicey now for traveling to Hawaii?
I think the impact will be, if this lasts long, I think this impact maybe is talking about 2 years because of the negotiation. I think this ripple impact is coming to the U.S. mainland, and that 61% of the visitors will be negatively impacted. But in terms of export, Hawaii has very small export to the European countries, and we have about $20 billion export. Out of the $20 billion is only about $15 billion are visitor spending. The other export is only $5 billion. It's small, mostly is to the U.S. mainland. But the U.S. export or trade balance to U.K. is generally is a deficit, which means we import more from.
Of course. But generally speaking, in this next two-year period where we really won't know until we go through it, exactly how the Brexit begins to look both in Europe and what its impact is on Hawaii, what advice are you giving briefly to Hawaii businesses that in some way or other have something to do with British or any visitor?
Yeah, I think we just... I think first, we don't need to worry too much. I think there are some opportunities, some challenges. I think there will be uncertainty during the next maybe 2 years. I think mostly is on the political aspect. So I think the economic impact to Hawaii, it might be not a significant one. But if this lasts long, and uncertainty is long, there will be an impact on the U.S. visitors. So we have some challenges. And I think my advice to the business is just do business as usual, and we just treat the European visitors as usual and with our aloha spirit. And I think that's it.
All right, Dr. Tian, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Dr. Eugene Tian is the chief economist with the Hawaii State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism. His office conducts studies on economic issues and produces the state's official economic forecast and the State of Hawaii data book.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2 at 8:14, almost 8:15. Coming up, a studio visit from Little Albert, but first, your quiz. These days, Brits are very much in the news, as we've just talked about, and at HPR 2 with its own Brexit of Michael Titterton. In today's Backyard Quiz, we remember an Englishman who changed the course of history in Hawaii, playing a vital role in the unification of the islands under Kamehameha I. It was he who introduced the warrior king to the European weaponry and battle tactics that played a pivotal role in his conquest of the islands. He was born in Lancashire in 1742 and arrived in the islands aboard the Eleonora when it put in at Kealakekua Bay in February 1790. He was sent ashore by the captain to search for a companion ship that had gone missing, only to be left behind when he didn't return after 2 days. He was resourceful enough to attach himself to the court and make himself indispensable to the king, and ended up spending the rest of his life in Hawaii as a trusted friend of the monarchy, who ruled as royal governor of Hawaii between 1802 and 1812. This morning, we're looking for his name. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get the right answer will get the HBR t-shirt.
Good morning. I'm John Ching from Talk Story Productions. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
If there's one special key to maintaining longevity in the music business, it's versatility. Tastes change faster than anyone can keep up, so the race is to the swift and the readily adaptable. Little Albert Malignat has spent his whole life in music as a child phenom with the Rockefellers in the late 50s and early 60s, as a member of SOS, the legendary show band, and as a solo artist. He's bringing all that history to the Blue Note tomorrow evening. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Albert.
Good morning, Chris. How are you doing, my friend?
All right.
Always wonderful to see you.
You've never known a world other than the stage, it seems.
That has been a blessing. It was a God-given gift, and through the years, 60 years to be precise, I've been on that stage.
You know, most people are so scared of getting on stage. Was it like that? I mean, you might have to have had a time as a little kid when you were scared?
Never.
Never?
Never. It was just one of the things that me and my brothers just enjoyed doing. You know, we couldn't get enough of it when we were young. And we were flying all over the place in Asia in the early days, and just meeting all kinds of people. And once we got on that stage, it was something that was just sparkled in.
Maybe you were too
mystic.
Young to get scared, you think? You know, kids don't get scared.
Yeah, no.
Kind of stuff.
No, but our father, we were scared of our father because our father was a musician back in the day. He went from Hong Kong to Shanghai back and forth. Meanwhile, we're getting born. You know, I was born in Shanghai, me and Eddie, who is 2.5 years younger than me. And we never showed our father singing. We kept it behind him when we were away, when he was away from us. And the only reason he knew that we were, had some kind of talent is he came down for my oldest brother's friend wedding. He invited us to sing and said, why don't you, you know, who was my oldest brother. So my brother, not knowing that the parents were good friends of my father came down from Shanghai to Hong Kong to surprise. So here we are, the four of us, we're singing, and our father comes walking in.
So that
was like, oh my gosh, you know, we're having fun, and then here comes Dad, but he was smiling from ear to ear.
Why didn't you want him to hear you?
I don't know.
Just shy?
Because Dad was, that was his thing, and we just did it for,
yeah,
you know, for fun. And but when we were in the Philippines, we, you know, there was like a Ted Mack amateur hour all the time on radio there. And we would go and perform these things and win.
So just, you wanted to get out to the public. You wanted to get out on stage and tour the world.
Not really. We just like, you know, it's like at that time it was just a hobby. And at that time we were singing like four songs at the most.
Yeah.
But there was a gentleman who owned a club, and my dad knew, in Hong Kong, and it was a huge hotel called the Imperial Hotel. At that time, it was the number one hotel and
that
club
was a real
inside.
Bad,
and
huh?
He said to my father, after we sang, he talked to him right away. He says, Morrow, which was my dad's name, he says, I want to see you in 3 weeks with your boys and you to do a show.
Now it's time to get serious.
Dad dropped everything, quit the band in Shanghai with just like that.
Wow.
And that's how we started the Rockefellers. Of course, my brother picked the name because he had a newspaper that said Mr. Rockefeller. And Mr. Rockefeller was, you know, a billionaire at that time.
It obviously worked for you, you know.
Yeah.
Listen, Albert, I want to leave time for you to do a little music because you brought your nylon string
guitar. Oh, yeah, so sure.
Whatever pops into your mind.
Well, you know, working with the Society 7 for almost my adult life back here in Hawaii, and it's been 25 years since I've stepped on that stage with the boys. So it's going to be a sentimental evening this Tuesday. Teary-eyed now, talking to you. Society 7 was a wonderful, wonderful group of guys, and I got to know a couple of them, Terry and Tony, back in the day in Hong Kong when we were kids. And one of the things that I really liked with SOS was impressions, voice impressions.
Oh, yeah.
We always try to do something that, you know, we can come close to. And this is one of the voices that I'm going to do that evening.
Well, I'll keep a watch on the time for you.
You can turn off anyway.
Okay.
You can say that you're leading me on, but it's just what I want you to do. Don't you notice how hopelessly I'm lost? That's why I'm far loving you. Look at me. I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree. And I feel like I'm clinging to her cloud. I can't understand, I get misty. Just holding your hand, I'm too misty, too much in love. Mr. Mathis.
Yes, I definitely picked up on that right away. That was uncanny.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's always a wonderful time to see you.
Well, there's so much we could talk about, but it's great to get a chance to hear you. Thanks so much for coming in.
No, of course. Of course. My pleasure.
Little Albert Malik Matt will perform tomorrow evening at the Blue Note Hawaii. And you can see his 1963 performance with the Rockefellers on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
How can the police be policed? The Newark case study.
The police department's stop and arrest practices have a disparate impact on the city of Newark's black residents.
What do the police see? A ride-along look with Newark, New Jersey's gang unit. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
$9.15. That's how much it costs to run the statewide network every minute of every day. That comes to $13,000 a day, $92,000 a week. These members understand that balancing a budget is important, and we gratefully acknowledge their support. John Wu and Christina Nguyen of Honolulu, Ryan Susago of Kula, and James Taylor of Haleiwa. If HPR adds quality to your life, become a member of Hawaii Public Radio and help us with the hard costs of radio. And you can call us or log on to hawaiipublicradio.org. It's open every minute of every day.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
Two Hawaii prisoners held in Arizona have died of a spore-borne disease not found in our state, and that has Civil Beat looking for some answers about the deadly dust. Reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
This is, you know, everyone knows that when you go to a different location, there may be certain diseases, there may be, you know, certain allergies that may crop up, but this, in this case, has turned deadly. What is it about valley fever that that causes potential problems to those who come from Hawaii?
Well, credit to Louis Kanea, our reporter, who's been looking into the fact that, as you know, we've got 1,400 prisoners from Hawaii in Arizona. And valley fever, boy, I was just in Phoenix myself a couple months ago and didn't know about this, but it's microscopic pores. It comes from a soil-dwelling fungus. And because in the Southwest, it's so dry and dusty and hot, well, it's very common for this to spread. Now, a lot of people, it doesn't bother them at all, but at least 40% experience flu-like symptoms, you know, fever and chills and so forth. But you can even develop meningitis and pneumonia. And there is some indication that at least one of the two prisoners from Hawaii who was housed at Saguaro may have died linked to this valley fever.
When you say may, do we not have hard data on this from the Department of Public Safety?
One of the autopsies said it was a heart attack, but did actually mention that Valley Fever was involved. The other autopsy is pending, according to the Department of Public Safety. They say they will get the records to us, but not anytime soon. Meanwhile, CCA, that's the huge prison company that runs Saguaro in Arizona, did not respond to our inquiries.
Corrections Corporation of America, the CCA.
Correct.
When they have obviously had other inquiries about this, too, there's nothing that's ever come back for them from them about any concern for prisoners that might be impacted or feel the impact of Valley Fever?
Well, I think the reality check here is that the fact that Valley Fever is a serious problem in the Southwest, and yet Saguaro, CCA, DPS, that's Public Safety Department, hasn't done anything about that. That's in contrast to California, where a couple of prison facilities prohibit housing certain inmates. It turns out that blacks and Filipinos are much more susceptible to Valley Fever. There's actually been lawsuits based on the Eighth Amendment, and that's cruel and unusual punishment. So the concern here is that we know about this problem, but there seems to be an indifference, an attitude of not really caring on the part of Hawaii and Arizona prison officials.
Which may make it ripe for potentially a lawsuit to bring the situation to a head.
Hey, that's exactly where we're going with this, and that in many ways is the only way to change things when you're combating CCA and the Department of Public Safety. Kudos to Louis Kanea for uncovering another great story about our prison situation.
All right, Chad, thanks very much for bringing this to us, and good to see you last night, by the way, at the event for Michael Titterton.
Great celebration. Thank you, Beth Ann.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat. It's now 8:30. Coming up, a foolproof way to motivate a losing team, and laughs will ensue, we guarantee. But first, we're going to check out world events coming to you from the BBC, and then we'll be back with you in just a bit.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, anger is just outright bad for you, isn't it?
Well, you know, studies are showing that when you get that sense where you're that upset and angry and you can feel your heart beating faster, you're actually shortening your lifespan.
Yeah, you're really doing some damage. You've got all kinds of stuff being released inside you, yeah?
You do. You have all of these different chemicals that your body makes that cause arteries to tighten, cause your body to undergo this different transformation and not get enough blood flow to certain areas. You know, it makes me think, is it really worth it when you're that upset in traffic?
Very rarely, I think, is probably the answer. But, you know, it's not something that is that easy to control, is it?
But we're going to learn some techniques today, some simple things that we can all do to diffuse a situation, whether we're the one getting very angry or we're the recipient of someone else getting very angry. So we're going to talk with some experts about how can you change anger to make it be something that'll help you to know that you need to take a different course and maybe use it as a way to help you be more productive.
So there's a psychological and a physiological aspect to all this, huh?
Absolutely. And we're going to talk about that connection today and how you can really channel that energy into a more productive place so that if you're angry about a situation, you can change how you interact in that situation, possibly change the outcome as well, which is really the goal because we want to either help the situation or at least stay safe and healthy.
So the idea is to keep calm and listen at 5 o'clock, huh?
You got it.
Thanks, Kathy. That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Up until a 2010 case that challenged the illegality of the practice, Hawaii special education students were routinely told they had to leave school by age 20. That despite a federal law assuring students the right to stay in school until they got a regular diploma or reach age 22. Although Hawaii changed its stance after a 2013 ruling, the court decided last year that students who were forced to leave early are entitled to receive free services from the DOE to make up for the time that they've lost. Even so, many of the students who would be affected by the ruling don't know what might be available to them, and actual services to class action lawsuit members have yet to start. Michelle Como is an attorney involved with the case, and she's with us this morning in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
This seems to be a pretty weighty decision, given Hawaii's history with special education, and yet it seems to have, in some ways, flown under the radar. How did that happen?
A weighty decision. Well, it was certainly an important decision. I mean, the passage of Act 163 in 2010 significantly hindered special education students in Hawaii because it kept them from school for an additional 2 years in some cases. So we were very gratified when the Ninth Circuit in 2013 repealed the law. And so that in itself was a great victory because it restored the right to go to school for hundreds and hundreds of people every year. In 2014, actually, the court issued its decision to allow those who were affected by the law to receive additional services. At that time, we got names of everyone who was affected from the DOE, and we did outreach to try to find as many people as possible.
But this seems to be, you know, sort of proof of what's, you know, some parents have told us, that in a post-Felix consent decree world, that things actually got worse by, A, having a law like this that would be passed in 2018 and then having to be repealed, and then now having all of these people out there and not necessarily understanding what import this particular change would have for them because they don't even know exists.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I mean, what we found in working on this case is that there are a lot of really good special educators out there, good teachers that provide services. The problem is when the system is sort of rigged, as in what happened in 2010. And so special education and the IDEA is about giving opportunity. It's not about outcome. It's about opportunity for people with special needs. And that's really what they're asking for, and that's what they deserve.
So. When you look at the breakdown of all the people that would serve, how does that look? What are the different components of that group that are all lumped together in this class action?
Well, right now we're looking to reach the older class members. So those are the folks that would have been affected by this law. And they would have been required to leave school at age 20 or kept from returning to school while the law was in place. What they have in common is they are between 22 and 27 years old right now. They received special education while they were in school, and they did not graduate with a diploma. So those are the folks we are looking for. In terms of what their disabilities are, you know, it really ranges. It's somebody who couldn't get a high school diploma by the time they were 20. So they tend to have a greater level of disability, but maybe not. They may have left on their own before then. And so disabilities can range from, I mean, I'm not a special education expert, but I know, you know, your disabilities, some people wear their disabilities on their face and you can see, you know, that this is a disabled person, and some people don't.
So you're talking physical disabilities as well as cognitive disabilities.
Yeah, it could be. Although folks who have strictly physical disabilities probably could have graduated, you know, if it was strictly something mobility related, for example, that person wouldn't have been necessarily held up from graduating. But yeah, it's anyone who didn't get a diploma and reached the age of 20.
How many people total are in this, are involved with this?
We got 1,800 names from the DOE in 2014. Subsequent to that, the judge held that some of them were too young. We think the number right now, I have to go back and look at my spreadsheet to know exactly how many, but it's in the range of 1,200. And we're still looking for, if you can believe it, about 800 of those folks.
So you've only managed to get about 400 of that group who know that this might be a possibility for them. What to do about that other 800? Was it because the information that was given to you wasn't necessarily current and good, or simply that for other reasons you've been able not to reach them?
Yeah, the DOE gave us some information in 2014, and they gave us what basically was old addresses, the last addresses that they had in their system. So we sent letters and we had calls made to try to reach those folks, and because the information was stale, we just couldn't get a hold of a lot of them. So we've got until September 19th, 2016. That's our deadline to what's called close the class. And so the judge has given us until then to try to find as many of these people as possible and try to get them to sign up for services or at least call us and talk to us so that they can find out what's involved and make a decision about whether they want to participate, yes or no.
Any sort of public awareness campaign that you have planned to be able to do this?
Well, we're here on the radio. We've got.
Well, we're interested in the case, but aside from the fact that, you know, you have our listenership, but
sure.
In general, for a lot of people that might not be listening at the moment, any way of reaching them?
Yeah, we've talked to a few different things. We're going to try to talk to some other news outlets as well and get some publicity there. And it's also what I found in doing this case is that the special education community is pretty tight-knit, and a lot of people know other people. And so we've got some advocates that are helping us in the community. So we talked to them as well and tried to say, you know, do you know anyone? Do you know anyone who might fit this profile? Please tell us. And we also talked about going to some locations where special education, former special education students might be now. So for some folks, that might be Goodwill. It might be SECO, the ARC, you know, places where they might be doing activities and involved now, and talking to some of the folks there to let them know about the lawsuit and let them know about the type of class member that we have.
So limited outreach is what I hear you say that you're going to be able to do, plus hoping that word of mouth will carry it in a small community that depends greatly on the Coconut Wireless.
Yeah, well, there's one more thing we've got to. What we got the judge to do was to order that instead of the stale contact information, that we would get to have better contact information. And so what she told us was that we could get the best current contact information from two agencies. So we picked the DMV and we picked MedQuest. And we've got the right to go to those agencies and now get the best contact information for our class members. So what we're really hoping to do is that those agencies will come back with good contact information, and we're going to try some direct outreach as well.
So you can up that number from 400 to hopefully as close to 1,200 as possible.
We're going to try.
We wish you all the best. We'll stay quite interested and look at what happens now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Michelle Como is an attorney at Alston, Hunt, Floyd & Ng in Honolulu, where she represents both large and small clients facing business and personal disputes, and she's been involved with this case since 2014.
In this morning's backyard quiz, we thought about an Englishman who served Kamehameha the Great as a trusted military political advisor and as a liaison to European visitors to the kingdom. He'd been left behind at Kealakekua Bay by the captain of the Eleonora in 1790, rapidly built up a friendship with Kamehameha. When Captain Vancouver came to Hawaii Island 3 years later and offered him passage home, he refused. He was already doing too well in Hawaii and would spend the rest of his life here. He was the man in charge of the cannon during the Battle of Nu'uanu, a battle that was won by artillery and gave Kamehameha dominion over the island of Oahu. He's buried in the royal mausoleum with this inscription: "Beneath this stone are deposited the remains of John Young of Lancashire, England, the friend and companion in war of Kamehameha, who departed this life 17 December 1835, in the 93rd year of his age and the 46th of his residence on the Sandwich Islands." And John Young is the name we were looking for.
Warren Haynes called us from Kahului, knew the answer, and will be receiving the T-shirt. If you have a question for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha. I'm Jeffrey Siegel, concert pianist, Keyboard Conversations. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet, as well as what to look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips for our weekly report. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's happening?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in our evening skies. Mars and Saturn can be seen relatively close together in the southern sky after sunset, with Jupiter making an appearance on the eastern horizon at around 10:43 p.m. The moon this week is approaching its waning crescent phase, meaning that we will have beautiful dark skies here in the islands, perfect for stargazing.
And one of the objects I doubt you'll be able to see is the planet that I think Christopher has news on and potential ocean under its surface.
That's right. This week we return to the outer solar system and to the magnificent dwarf planet Pluto. Recently, NASA's New Horizons spacecraft got the chance to study Pluto on its journey into the outer solar system. New Horizons was able to collect thousands of high-resolution images of Pluto's surface, which showed us for the first time what this mysterious frozen world looked like. Since then, scientists have been furiously searching for clues in these pictures that could tell us just what's going on under the surface of Pluto. And they may have found something very interesting indeed. Signs of an ocean under the surface.
What kind of technology is at work, or how are they making that discovery?
Well, scientists have been looking very closely at features on the surface, such as canyons, mountains, and valleys. These features are tectonic features, as they are known, like mountain ranges and canyons here on the Earth. And these features can give us clues as to what's going on under the surface.
And what kind of things are they learning?
Well, these features allow us to build up a theory as to the geological history of Pluto and how the surface has changed over time. What they discovered is that Pluto must have had an ocean underground at some point in the past. The big question is now, is that ocean still liquid or has it frozen completely?
Gotta believe that thing's frozen, right? It's so far away from the sun.
Well, one would think so. If there is an ocean, it would be under a sheet of ice about 190 miles thick, deep down close to the planet's core, where it might still be warm.
Christopher Phillips and another fascinating stargazer, this time on the edge of the solar system. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Aristophanes really hit on something when he created his classic comedy, Lysistrata, in which the women of Athens withhold their favors in order to bring about peace on the battlefield, only to generate a fair amount of unrest at home. The musical comedy Lysistrata Jones upends the time-honored premise a little bit. Now the battlefield is a basketball court, and the goal is to win. Brad Powell is directing the Mono Valley Theater production that opens next week, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you. With a show like this, you know, for a director, I mean, where to begin? There's music cues, there's basketball, there's romance. What do you, you know, how do you keep it all together?
You are right. There are so many different aspects to this. And one of the wonderful things is that Manoa Valley has a great technical staff.
Uh-huh.
So we've had a lot of help from the set constructor, and the set is going to be marvelous. They've torn everything down, lowered the floor, so we're in a gymnasium, and it looks just like a high school or college gym.
So you've got hoops, you've got the whole thing, right?
Right. Well, we've got one hoop so far. We hope to get the other one up before we open.
Well, one hoop will get you by, right?
Right. We can at least practice there.
With a musical comedy, it's a lot of the success is kind of keeping the show moving along, right?
Right. And this show has no problem with that. It moves so fast. There are four basketball games in it. Some are look straight, like straight basketball. Others are dance. The way it's put together is really a lot of fun. And, of course, the girls, who are the cheerleaders, they're the ones that show off and have all the fun during the games, trying to get the boys to win. The boys, on the other hand, they just want to get through school. This school, a university, Athens University, has not won a basketball game in 30 years. And so there has never been any reason to try to win. Anybody who's on the basketball court is just there for the popularity and to get through college. And so Lysistrata is a transfer student. She comes in, and she sets everything on its ear. And she refuses to go out with the captain of the basketball team until he wins a game.
So motivation is the problem.
Absolutely.
With this team.
Right.
And they've just, that sounds like after 30 years, they've just lost all will to live. Right.
Right. The alumni, nobody cares.
Yeah. So she's the driver of the plot, and then she enlists her fellow cheerleaders to withhold their...
She has to do some convincing. The girls don't want to give up having the dates with the boys, so she has a lot of convincing to do. But the gal, Jody Bill Buckler, is just wonderful. She is ideal for the part, and she has so much energy and so much drive. She actually encourages the cast to do the job.
So her character is a spark plug, it sounds as if.
Right.
And she's that
and
kind
she's
of
just
actress.
Exactly that.
How tough was it to cast this play?
It was amazingly difficult.
You have to be able to play basketball, right?
Well, that's what they said.
Uh-huh.
We got to the point where we didn't care.
Uh-huh.
Because they don't win. So I wasn't too concerned.
Not actually, as if you had to be good. Huh?
At the rehearsal last night, there's a couple of boys who have worked so hard, they keep making baskets. I keep saying, stop making the baskets. It's just, you're not supposed to be that good.
Yeah.
But the casting was a problem because Mamma Mia was auditioning. We had so many musicals that everybody wanted to be in.
Yeah.
And Lysistrata Jones was the lesser known of all the shows that are going on in town.
Mm-hmm.
And so it amazed me. My other problem was that during auditions, I had to be in Los Angeles because I was working in L.A. And so I had to have early auditions. And there were very few people who were interested. But the beautiful thing was that Jody was one of the first people who auditioned, and I breathed a sigh of relief because I knew we had the main girl. And then we were able to cast the girls pretty quick, and then we got half of the boys. And then we struggled for almost 2 months trying to get the rest of the boys. And it is amazing to me how things like this happen. People became available. And it wasn't whether or not we needed to cast them, but it was because they were the only ones that were available. And they fit the roles perfectly.
Huge sigh of relief for you, right?
Oh, yeah. And we didn't get the last boy until 2 days before we started rehearsals.
Well, this is this offers a little bit of insight into what your job is, Brad, because it's kind of like a mosaic, right? You're putting all these pieces in place, and maybe only you know where all the pieces are supposed to go.
And many times I don't even know which piece goes where.
Yeah. But it's a process that involves a lot of sort of happy surprises, right? Where you just luck into something that works.
And we are ecstatic. Keith Griffin, the music director, and I are just overwhelmed at how wonderful the cast is, how perfect they are for their roles, and how it's coming together so beautifully.
Sounds as if you got it down to a really effective running time, too.
Yes. I'm surprised. Most musicals run about 2.5 hours, and even with the intermission, we'll come in probably just a little over 2 hours. So it's very tight, very fast, and of course, basketball speeds things up if it's played right, and the songs are so much fun, and it has a gamut of styles, from rap to musical comedy to rock and roll.
You know, you always think of that moment in musical comedy when there's the love song. Uh-huh. Is there such a song in this show?
Actually, there's two.
Uh-huh.
There are two beautiful solos. Lysistrata has one, and the basketball captain has one. Because in the process of the play, you think they're going to get together,
uh-huh,
because she starts dating him immediately. But it ends up that they both find somebody else. And it's when they sing those songs to their new counterpart that we have some very beautiful, beautiful songs.
That's another twist, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Sounds like a lot of fun, Brad.
Oh, it is great.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Brad Powell is the director of Lysistrata Jones, which opens July 7th, runs until the 24th at Mono Valley Theater, and you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I need someone to set a pit for me at the free throw line of life. Someone I can pass to. Someone to hit the open man on to give him go and not end up in the popcorn machine. So cheerleaders, help me out.
Basketball job. I got a basketball job.
Oh, that sounds so sweet.
I got a basketball job.
Sing it out.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Pacific University, celebrating 50 years of educating students from Hawaii, the mainland, and around the world, offering 50 undergraduate and 14 graduate degrees. hpu.edu.
Avid shell collectors are pushing an iconic species towards extinction.
The biggest threat to the Nautilus is absolutely overfishing for its shell. Scientists often refer to this creature as a living fossil because they really haven't changed that much in the 500 million years they've been in existence.
Saving the exquisite Nautilus before it's too late. I'm Steve Hurwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
This afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
Beth Ann, we often wonder with some of our American elections if people really knew what they were voting for. It's not that uncommon, is it?
Well, no. And in Britain, when you're listening to a lot of the reports that are coming out and that came out yesterday during a lot of the Sunday shows and this morning on Morning Edition, there are many people who kind of wonder what they did when they voted. And you wonder, how could you go in there and vote without really knowing? Or they were trying to cast protest votes and didn't really think that leaving was going to be an option and that it would carry the day. But, you know, interesting that they don't bother to entertain that idea before they cast their vote.
Well, you hear this with initiative and referendum votes, where the wording is really complicated. You read them in the voting booth and then say, I wonder what it just did.
Well, tomorrow we're going to find out what Neil Conan has to say about Brexit.
And a local documentarian sets out in search of the Yeti. If you'd like to be in touch, we have options. You can call us at our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
And if you'd like to get a past show, they're all available on the HPR archive. You can listen to parts you want or the whole thing. And there are links to more about the topics and guests there, too. Just look under Talk Shows for the conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandergood.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning for more of the conversation.